Hello, this is David Rovics hosting another live stream broadcast, which is appearing on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, Cable Community Radio, and various other platforms. During the pandemic, since I can no longer tour and play music for a living, I've taken to interviewing people of interest most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT, and doing a house concert from my living room on the last Saturday of every month at 1 p.m. Pacific, along with various other live streaming activities. Every Tuesday, the broadcast has an actual producer, longtime Detroit area talk show host and Fifth Estate magazine editorial collective member, Peter Werby. These days, Fifth Estate is a quarterly print magazine that has been published in one form or another since its founding in 1965. You can read the entirety of the spring issue online at fifthestate.org. You can also subscribe to the print magazine there and hear previous episodes of Fifth Estate Live as well. Today's guest is Ben Olson, musician, poet, and regular contributor to the Fifth Estate, currently living in New York City and working on getting a graduate degree in philosophy at the New School. Ben Olson, welcome to Fifth Estate Live. You came to New York City to get a degree in philosophy, studying civilization and its traumatic impacts on humans. And then the global pandemic hits, and you're in the middle of one of the biggest cities in the world. I mean, it's just like the contradictions, the multiple contradictions involved in that whole sentence is really quite mind-boggling to begin with. But can you just tell us something about what I don't know. I said knowing where to start is always the hardest thing. Talk about the domestication of humans to begin with, would you? And any particular insights that you have into that related to the pandemic? That's too big a thing to jump. That's a good hour of question right there. So we have an hour. So.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, let's just jump in. I guess really the only insights that I have about the domestication of humans are my own insights into my own experience. And I try to really limit my supposed insights to that realm, because I find that I get the best results that way. And that's because I think that domestication is best studied as an experience. Maybe not best studied in that way, but perhaps I should just say that's I think where my insights at least come from. It's something that I think I find, if not itself directly traumatic, perhaps related to a traumatic experience, which, if not always my own traumatic experience, may be rooted somewhere in what I think of as the prehistory of humans.
Mm-hmm. It seems like, I mean, in terms of traumatic experiences, one of the things that always kind of has struck me is how traumatizing it is for most people to just go through what we call a happy childhood. You know, I mean, if you're not being abused in any kind of classic kind of way by any by your parents or your siblings or something like that, just going to school, even a really nice school, so-called, in a nice suburban town or whatever, can really mess you up badly. I think just the usual typical normal so-called experiences, it can be so profoundly traumatic. I mean, I think a lot of people are wondering, like, what happened to me? Why am I so traumatized? I had nice parents, and I wasn't, sexually molested at the age of 5 or whatever. Like, and I'm still all messed up. And yeah, it's just normal life, huh? That does it to people.
I have to agree with the element of education involved in the domestication of humans. And specifically being a potentially often traumatic element. I think Daniel Quinn was right when he said that education, at least primary education, is essentially an institution to, in a sense, babysit kids whose parents have to go to work every day. That's essentially its purpose as an institution in human life. But it's also where a lot of the magic of existence tends to stop for most people. And that in itself, I think, is, it can be described as traumatic in the sense that something is being sort of buried or denied. There's an element of experience which one, or from which one, is being dissociated. In this case, the kind of enchantment of life itself, which for many of us ends at kindergarten.
Yep. Although although that sometimes it doesn't end in nursery school or pre-K, and that's it seems to me, and it's often because of how pre-K is run. If it's a nice one, it's still, they're just playing, basically. It's a bunch of kids playing together, and that can be a nice, it can be a nice thing depending on how that goes. But then by kindergarten, they're all sitting in desks and getting the what, you know, the spirit sort of more or less beaten out of them. But this is not necessarily the case in some places, like that emphasis that where child, as they call it, child driven education, or you know, emphasis on emotional intelligence, or whatever kind of jargon they're using. But it's to describe an atmosphere where the kids get to actually be sort of having a good time together and playing and being happy and not getting, you know, sitting in straight rows and desks like Waldorf education or something. It can vary that whole experience, but fairly widely, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. I think its institutional purpose may remain to some extent, but yeah, there are definitely ways of, I don't know, sweetening the deal to some extent, right? Where you can add a little bit more of, you know, what you call the child-driven element in education to make it somewhat less, to water down the violence of it, right?
Right.
To make it somewhat more palatable, which is not to, I mean, you know, be so kind of like militant-minded about this, but that's my take on it.
Yeah, I mean, like if just for example, if you living in this society and you have to work a job that you probably in most cases would rather not be working because you have to do something like pay rent or mortgage that most people would rather not be paying. And then if you have a kid for one reason or another, and you're going to have to put them somewhere while you're working, then you might end up putting them in a Waldorf school or something. But it's a whole series of not preferable choices, right? That
right.
We are stuck with making generally. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And speaking of being stuck with making a whole series of choices that are not preferable, I mean, just I'm like, given what you're, I don't know where you grew up, but it wasn't in a massive city like New York, or where do you grow up?
So I grew up in Pasadena, California, which is a fairly suburban, kind of conservative or historically more conservative city in Southern California. I moved out here here to New York about 17 years ago. Initially,
either way,
to study.
You were very familiar with the megalopolis anyway.
I didn't move here from a farm or anything like that.
But although it's a bit different, hardly ever being able to see the sky, right? Or not being able to see the sun, like in a place like Manhattan, people don't, it's hard to picture until you get there and you realize that there's, you basically have to go to the river or to the Central Park if you want to actually have sunlight cast upon your body, because otherwise you're just in the shadow of a skyscraper at all times, right?
Yeah, well, here in Queens, the buildings are a little lower, so you do get some access to sky. But yeah, I mean, that and light pollution as well. I mean, at night, you really don't tend to see many stars at all. You're lucky if you see any.
If we I mean, like we could talk about where people went wrong in the first place with civilization and the trauma that but there, you're one of the things you've written about is how the basic act of sort of settling into agricultural societies and domesticating animals actually had the impact of us domesticating ourselves and sort of doing this, committing the same kinds of trauma to ourselves, to our own species, that we were also committing to animals by domesticating them. Is that a fair sort of summary of one of your theses? Or
yeah, it is. And one of the things I find really fascinating about the history or prehistory of civilization is the question of how and why humans would have started doing it in the first place. There seems to be no question that it itself is a at least potentially traumatizing act. But there's another question of whether it's a traumatic act, namely an act that's rooted in a trauma. And so whether or not the act of domesticating plants and animals is representative of some sort of traumatic experience in the prehistory of humans. And that's what I find the most fascinating. And then as an extension of that, how that potentially traumatic event is communicated across generations, and so that it lives in me, you know, someone who I just said I wasn't raised on a farm. I have no experience with hands-on domestication, and yet I'm in some real way affected by, you know, this event in my species prehistory. How does that event get communicated across generations to come to live in me?
Yeah, because you don't necessarily need to like brand somebody with a tattoo to traumatize them. I mean, it's like it's different. You don't have to do all the same things that you're going to do to a farm animal to your children to still traumatize them with this whole structure that we've set up. But the structure has changed so much over the thousands of years, the sort of structures of civilization. I mean, we didn't used to have mandatory education and standing armies and this sort of thing. But what do you think was the, do you have any ideas about what was that prehistoric trauma that could have, it was something other than just population pressures, as the traditional theory goes about why we started farming in the first place?
Well, interestingly, Freud at one point, and I don't think he continued to believe this, but at one point Freud thought that it had to do with traumas related to the Ice Age, and that this kind of caused a sort of general anxiety about the Earth's ability to provide for humans. So, you know, that, you know, maybe in some sense this contributed to a more kind of anxious relationship with our ecological surroundings, and less of ease or reliance on, you know, the Earth to provide for us.
Because, like, does the archaeological, I mean, I know that from what I've read anyway, there's been a lot of advances in soil archaeology over the past several decades. So there's a lot more that can be understood about prehistory just from soil analysis than used to be possible. And I don't know how far back that kind of stuff goes, but is it known that for sure that people started farming 12,000 years ago or so, or might we have been farming prior to the last ice age, and it's just too far back to be able to know that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I wouldn't say that it's known in a distinct sense. It perhaps it went back further. I think that's an intriguing question to think about, you know, sort of like first of all, how far back it goes. Also, when you can really say is the beginning of the Anthropocene era in general. How do you really trace back the actual origins? To what extent were people doing things kind of close to agriculture that weren't a full-on or for the most part subsistence on agricultural activity, right? To what extent were people kind of flirting with that way of life prior to the so-called agricultural revolution? I mean, that's not entirely clear to me.
Because it seems, I mean, one of the other things that it seems pretty clear now that people have been flirting with agriculture in one way or another for a very long time. Just, but in terms of like what we think of as agricultural society, in terms of most everybody basically tied to the land where they're working their asses off on farms in a class structured society, like this is what we think of, right? As like, 'cause, like when Europeans first invaded the Americas and found all this agriculture going on, they didn't recognize it as agriculture necessarily, right? It, because it wasn't like people living on farms with fences and all that.
Yeah, well, I think part of it has to do with the success of agricultural activity. Like one of the things like Chelis Glendinning points out in her book, My Name is Chelis and I'm in Recovery from Western Civilization, is that the better we, and Daniel Quinn talks about this as well, obviously, is that the better we get at agriculture, the worse the experience is for us, right? Because we increase the population, only from the success of crops, right? For instance, this only makes it harder to stop doing it.
Right, because it's a feedback loop, right? We have more kids to work the land, and then they need to eat, and then we need to work more land, and then, yeah, so the
Yeah.
slow spread, right?
Yeah,
Ben,
and
you,
this, well,
continue.
and yeah, this feedback loop is actually, yeah, to me, I find it very very representative of traumatic experience in general, specifically that dissociation, right? That kind of like leftover of your own behavior, that alienated activity that sort of comes back to haunt you. It sort of pits you into this cycle. So that's just that phrase that you used, feedback loop. I find that very, very descriptive of the traumatic elements in domestication.
You just end up repeating it just the way that we repeat our bad childhoods or whatever kind of childhoods if we're not incredibly if we don't make such an effort at reprogramming ourselves, we're just going to do the same thing to our children that we had done to us, no matter what we think we're going to do differently, right? It seems from my own personal experience as a parent, you know, it's if I didn't already analyze everything that's going on these dynamics way before actually experiencing them with a child, I'm just going to do the same thing my parents did on autopilot and then regret it, you know, a few hours later or whatever. You know, this is, yeah.
Well,
It, we,
and like you mentioned before, I mean, you don't have to have had like a traumatic childhood to kind of to inherit the traumas of domestication, right? So to break that cycle, it can be tricky because, I mean, you're not saying I want to do things differently because of some explicit horrors that I endured as a child. I mean, so it's a subtle change that you want to make happen. And it can be difficult to make such a subtle change when your own behaviors are so restricted by so-called civilized society.
sure. Yeah. We can't program away our, I mean, we whatever our programming is, we're going to be something we're stuck with, however to whatever degree we recognize it or not, I suppose. Can you talk about, I know that you've inevitably had thoughts about the current historical moment that we're in with the pandemic and the lockdown. And I mean, the trauma that people are experiencing explicitly as a result of the isolation and the unpredictability and the, you know, economic situation, so much of the world, there's so many different sources of trauma at the moment, but it's, I'm sure that it's also reflecting on the things that you're studying about as well at the same time.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I'd say about it is staying inside all day is, well, it's hard to do, but it also, the fear and the anxiety of contracting a virus, which is outside your home, is so, it's just such a rich experience when you're thinking about things like trauma of domestication, fear of the outside, right? Fear of nature. It's, I mean, like the pandemic experience is a perfect example of that kind of fear of nature and anxiety towards nature. So there's that. And then there's also, I personally, I was out of work for a little over a month before I went back to work. And I was really scared to go back, specifically to ride the subway and just to, you know, interact with other human beings face to face. And within about a week or so, I noticed that that fear hadn't gone away, but its pitch had become muted. And I guess I interpret this as a kind of a denial, maybe a necessary denial, so that I could kind of keep going. I mean, it's really hard to sustain that level of panic while you're out there, you know, interacting with the panic-inducing situation itself. So it's kind of hard to shut it off and then notice that you're shutting it off without turning it back on. It's a weird kind of game of hopscotch, you know, where you're always kind of one step behind yourself.
Yeah. That's the, I think about that in regards to driving a car a lot, because when you, you know, if it's something you haven't done in a while, or if any number of other things, like, you know, I mean, psychedelic drugs, if you take LSD or mushrooms and you break that mold in your mind that puts everything in its boxes, or if you experience schizophrenia or any number of other things, I suppose it can lead you to think about things in a different way than the way you might normally think about them. From my own experience, mainly as a young teenager and in my 20s, I found psychedelic drugs to be extremely useful in that sort of in analyzing my own programming, because I would have the experience of questioning things that I never thought about otherwise, like that were just automatic, you know, ways that I interacted with the world or ways that I thought about things that I hadn't questioned since I was a small child. And I think one random example is speeding around in a car going impossible speeds that, you know, a century ago, most people theorizing about the subject didn't think that humans were going to be capable of controlling something going at such speeds. And now it's just everyday experience. And we drive the cars on roads where we're going head on towards other cars and constantly trusting that all those other drivers are not going to just take a slight left turn and go right into us. And if they did, there's nothing we could do about it, basically, you know, depending on the timing, basically nothing. You're just trusting that, you know, and if you think for a moment, if you let yourself feel what you're actually experiencing on some level, then it's terrifying and you can never do it, you know, but you have to, you have to just drop that whole, all that anxiety about the death that you, it's around the corner any second, just in order to do that daily activity that most people in this country do every day.
Yeah, that, and you brought up something really interesting, which is the element of faith in other people, which seems so precarious to me. It's almost like an unconscious faith, right? Because if you think about it too much, you sort of like lose the faith, right? It's a lot more of like a denial of what's happening to me. That's how I think of it. You know, when you're on the freeway, and yeah, you realize, as you said, you know, if somebody else didn't, you know, cooperate in the same safety measures or what have you, you could pretty much very likely die or kill someone or both. If you thought about that too much, I don't think you could do it quite as smoothly. I noticed that a lot, especially when I'm on the subway. I think a lot about the fact that other people around me, they're just you know, human animals, like the same way I experience myself. And they may or may not feel as timid as I do around other humans. And if they were to want to act on some aggressive impulse, you know, they like there's a possibility that someone could just physically attack you really at any moment. I don't have like an explicit faith in others not to, but in a sense I kind of have to just not think about it so much. And that's what makes it so surprising when someone does act on those aggressive impulses and just sort of, you know, irrationally attack a complete stranger or you know, God forbid, like, you know, act on those sudden cravings to just veer to the left for no reason, you know, and cause some horrific collision on the highway. It makes it all the more startling and just kind of shattering of your daily conceptions of what life is like in human society when something like that does happen, because you sort of remember, you know, that we're all it. I mean, in a very real sense, and this sounds, you know, like a fun phrase, it's really not. In a very real sense, we're all wild animals, you know, walking around. And those of us who don't act on those aggressive impulses, I mean, the reason that we're not acting on them can have to do with not wanting to hurt others, or it could have to do with being afraid of the consequences of hurting others. And, you know, people are weighing those different motivations in their mind all the time. And people do snap. And when they do, or when we do, it reminds us what a precarious situation we are all in socially around each other.
I guess there must be people out there who never think about acting on violent impulses and just assume that nobody else is thinking about it too, or just figuring that they go, that these are the rules, and we all I mean, what strikes me is that about people so often is that there's a basic, it's not talked about much, but we all to such a large degree are playing by certain sets of rules, whether written or unwritten. And if we stop playing by those rules, there's no degree of authority in any society that could necessarily, you know, make everybody behave themselves. You know, we have these rules, like you drive on the right side of the road or the left side of the road, and you know that things are going to go really badly for a lot of people, including yourself, if you violate that basic rule, right? So then, I mean, I guess there's a lot of other things like that. Like you don't attack people in the subway, even if you're having a bad day, because it's just, you just don't do that. But then again, there are, of course, all sorts of potential consequences, not just from authority figures, but from just other people in the subway who might not take kindly to you attacking some other person on the subway, right? So there's, again, the society kind of thing where people know that this is just not done. And if you do veer off of those norms, then things will go badly, like whether you're peeing in the subway or attacking somebody or driving on the wrong side of the road or any number of inappropriate behaviors that might or might not be violent but are just not done. I don't know. So that the amount of cooperation that goes on is what often strikes me about these these cutthroat capitalist societies where we're being told we need to be greedy and compete with each other all the time, but actually so much of anything going smoothly depends on us cooperating with each other most of the time.
Yeah. It's not a hard thing to do, in my opinion, to cooperate. But then again, I'm a very timid person. And I've definitely had moments in my life where I really wanted to act on those destructive impulses. And not having acted on them in the moment, I can say for sure those destructive impulses have played out in my life on a less conscious level. But it's, it's definitely there. And I certainly don't think that cooperative tendencies are just the result of trauma. I think it's obviously in some very real senses pleasant often to cooperate, right? Because I mean, true cooperation means that you would get what you want, right? And also there's a feeling of empathy involved in cooperating with others. And that gives a sense of intimacy with people around you, which is definitely not only pleasant, but necessary, I think, to daily human existence. I don't want to overstate this kind of like death drive aggressiveness that's being denied, but I mean, I do think it's there
it's there. Yeah. Every day there's a massacre, right? We're having like an average of one massacre per day. So, I mean, just to take that random example of how that particular death drive manifests in this society, especially is one of the more overt expressions.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and even the calm in a capitalist society is, it's rooted in things that aren't calm and aren't cooperative. I mean, it's rooted in just very real violence. It's just that violence isn't in front of us. That violence isn't, necessarily here. But, we definitely, I think, are in some way aware of the violence that our calm is rooted in. And I think that's also kind of disturbing to the psyche, right? Like just that kind of that awareness that, that the calm of your society depends on violence elsewhere. It's really disturbing. And especially if you don't think that you could very easily, escape a society that is rooted in violence elsewhere. Or even if you could sort of get out of it and find yourself capable of living without it, that there would be somewhere else to go, right? That would be, free of potentially being, taken by, whatever the those forces of violence which create these supposedly calm societies. So it's really hard to kind of live with that, right? And it kind of comes down to, how do you operate a motor vehicle going, so many miles per hour, knowing, you could kill somebody or yourself at any moment, and even outside of your own decision making process, the car could backfire or something. You don't really know what's going on mechanically with the automobile. you have to kind of block this kind of stuff out just to like function. And blocking it out, it's definitely not the same thing as getting rid of it. I mean, it's
Right.
always there, and it's like, in many ways, so much worse when you block it
Yep.
out, right?
Because it goes somewhere. I mean, and every day that you're living in some rent burdened city like New York or Portland, and you're working two jobs in order to just pay your exorbitant rent every month, there's so much violence involved with that entire equation. How much sleep deprivation, how much you have to ignore your children, how much you have to do things you'd rather not be doing involving TV sets and your children and whatever, just all the different things that people that do go through just to be able to get through the their lives in situations like that. And it's and yet if you talk about killing the landlord, or you think about killing the landlord, or you put up signs on the telephone poles about how much you want to kill the landlord, then you're either crazy, or you're a sociopath, or you're acting out on violent impulses, or you're a very angry person, or only among certain subset of society are such activities considered to be acceptable.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because
It's
that's
on
the
my
kind
mind a
of
lot.
yeah. Well, yeah, I think it's on a lot of people's minds nowadays. It's the sort of thought that I've noticed is more easily expressed artistically. And if you talk about that kind of stuff, in a more kind of like raw, intellectual way, it's very off-putting to people, and it's disturbing to them, and like you said, it's like, who is this guy? Some sort of angry, sociopath or psychopath. But yeah, if you kind of, I know you're a musician, and I'm a musician too. I don't know
Yeah,
if,
I was
what's your
just going to
experience
mention
with
that.
that?
That's, yeah,
I mean, do you
absolutely.
find that that helps you kind of express it in a more digestible form?
Absolutely. And yeah, I wanted to ask you on your thoughts on that and other subjects related to music. But yeah, because one of the things like I read about a few years ago, which a scientific study I have been quoting regularly since I read about it, which was scientists were studying the, where thoughts go in the brain and stuff like that, and when you hear people speaking or singing, and what they discovered, which all musicians already knew, is when you sing words, they go to the emotional centers of the brain and they get processed differently than when you speak words. And so it's, I mean, it's clearly true. Everybody has experienced it if you've performed. And you'd do a song, unless you can, if you avoid the real alarm bell words that are gonna kind of shift people into cerebral f mode. And you just talk in more common language, and it's in the form of a song. Yeah, the most radical, crazy, violent, whatever kinds of ideas can be expressed, and they can be understood and related to and empathized with, and they don't freak people out. You can get a room full of senior citizens singing about burning down Monsanto, and they're like, oh, it's fun, it's a song, and sometimes even younger people in the room are like, oh, we might get arrested, and the old people are like, oh, burn it down. It's just a song. That could be interesting right there. But let me just say that you're tuned to Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you every Tuesday on various platforms, including the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio. You can find all the episodes archived in audio form at fifthestate.org, where you can also subscribe to the Fifth Estate print magazine. And the next one is coming up soon, and it will include an article by Ben Olson, as well as one by me and many other folks. But yes, please continue. Do you remember what you know?
Yeah, I was just going to say, there's really there's not a lot like performing music. That feeling of communicating something that might not be so easily communicated otherwise, in other kind of formats of communication. And as you pointed out, getting people who might not otherwise think about this stuff or, you know, much less celebrate it, to really like get on board with a particular idea. It's a thrilling experience. I've definitely had periods in my life where I was able to kind of get people to, you know, sort of shout along with certain phrases that might be a little inappropriate or you know, have to do with something that you know, they might not really endorse otherwise. And I've definitely had moments where I sort of felt a little manipulative in that technique, right? Like where I'm going to trick you into thinking something that you didn't think before, or you know, even to singing along with something that I don't think you probably agree with otherwise, but it's in a song, so you know. So I mean, there's something fun about that. But I mean, I've been kind of going through this this conflict in myself where I can't decide if I still want to, and maybe this just has to do with a faulty method on my end, but I can't decide if I still want to, you know, manipulate people in this way. Of course, I was doing it in a manipulative way at times. I don't think that it's impossible to, you know, get people to think about things that they wouldn't think about otherwise without manipulating them. But in the context of music, that I don't know. I guess I'm sort of experiencing this kind of a conflict with it, as far as whether I want to express certain ideas in music, or if I think it's kind of better to, you know, do it outside of the musical context. I myself have often used music as a way of softening the edges and making it a little bit more, a little easier for myself even, right, to like communicate it, right? Because like I don't have to cite sources in a song, you know, I can just, yeah, I don't have, there's no footnotes on an album. I mean, you know, so it's just, it's, there's for me, there's been an element of like, you know, kind of laziness or thinking that I'm sort of being a little bit of a trickster about things, which is fun, you know, if you can stomach that, you know, that kind of an activity. But then there, I don't know, there kind of comes a point where you know, you want to express these things outside of an artistic context just because it feels a little bit more honest, I guess. So
And
I've
that's
sort
where
of,
you're at right
I mean,
now, right? I mean, you pretty much
yeah.
you stopped writing songs 2 years ago, and that coincided with going to graduate school, and that was not a coincidence.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah. I wouldn't say, I mean, I would say, yes, I stopped writing songs, but it's really hard to stay away from music once you kind of like know how to do it in any kind of, you know, elementary way. Like, to like to know how to play guitar and to not play it, it's really difficult to do. So I mean, I definitely still play music, but I don't, yeah, I don't write songs, and I don't, I certainly don't perform or anything like that.
I mean, I've always found that the thing about writing songs is it's th that's particularly not more than just the fact that you're playing music and that the words rhyme and that has an effect on people. What has an effect on people? And of course, if it's good music, I think, however that's defined, I think, or people like it, you know, that has more of an effect as well. But what I find people are able to be more receptive about is stories rather than telling people what I think or what I feel or what they should think or feel, which is kind of a not unique to songs, but it's that kind of storytelling. I mean, it's also potentially manipulative because you're telling a certain story, not another story. And of course, the story you're telling is it may be going to lead people to have certain ideas and thoughts that you want them to have, you know. So it's, of course, although I do find I have written songs. I wrote one song that seems to be popular among fascists on YouTube, actually, and I
Oh,
think
is that true?
they don't. Yeah, they don't seem to get the irony of the song, which is disturbing, but I guess it's always when you write a song with irony, you always are running that risk that somebody's just going to take it literally and think you are, I don't know. Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. But... yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. You hit on two things here that are pretty interesting. First of all, so expressing ideas through music, but specifically through music that takes the form of or that makes use of a storytelling method. That's interesting because now you're sort of, you know, if you think of it as the idea comes first, and which I don't know if you do, and maybe this is arguable in you know music writing in general, but if you think of it as, you know, there's the idea and then there's the expression of the idea in music, you're now couching it in another artistic level, the storytelling. So now you've got, you know, multiple dimensions of communication going on, which is interesting. Also, that element of potentially being misunderstood in a song drives me crazy. And that's enough for me to just want to throw my hands up and say I'm not doing this anymore, you know, especially like you know, having people really like kind of find what they think is a common thread, you know, in a song, and you didn't put that thread there. You know, it's like, you know, like in your case, you know, being celebrated by fascists, it's sort of like, well, I mean, I don't know. I'm curious, what do you do in that case? Do you just sort of like, well, I guess if they're misunderstanding it, like, whatever, I'm not, do you correct them? Like, I don't know. How do you respond to that?
I mean, at first I was just, every time a fascist popped up on YouTube, I would just block them because I don't really, see the point in having, you know, spending the time on having discussions with people in that forum. Although I have to say, I have engaged in discussions and I haven't flipped out at people, I have actually successfully won people over to my side. You know, communication works and, you know, but it's very time consuming, and it's much more time consuming than putting up a song and then seeing what happens. You know, that's much easier than the individual communicating with people who disagree with you, you know, but generally I just don't do anything now because I just feel like, what can I do? I mean, if they misinterpret the song, and they think I'm saying exactly the opposite of what I'm saying, it's just too weird. It's like, I mean, it's as weird as Reagan using Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen as a patriotic song. I mean, it's like, okay, my song is a little less slightly less overtly anti-war. That song is obviously an anti-war song, that Born in the USA, right? And you, of course, you have to listen to the verses to understand that, but and you know, which obviously a lot of politicians were not doing at the time when they were using that song as their campaign song, you know, which was totally bizarre. But I guess the song I wrote, which is called "Send Them Back," which is about the MS St. Louis passengers on the ship in 1939 being sent back, being denied entry to Cuba, the U.S., and then Canada, and then being sent back to Europe, and so the song is based on English language press at the time, which was saying send these dirty Jews back. They're all a bunch of communists and they're Germans anyway. So, you know, all the different reasons why they shouldn't be let in. You know, they're communists, and if they're not communists, they're fascists, and anyway, they're all greedy and whatever. You know, I mean, all this kind of propaganda, which is in the song, which is obviously propaganda. But if you believe all that stuff and you don't have any sense of irony, well, I mean, yeah, I don't know. So maybe I wrote a song for the fascists to use, but it seems like if they actually played the song for anti-fascists, right, it would immediately be recognized as an anti-fascist song. So it's,
right.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. But these things can happen with more, you know, sort of subtle forms of communication like storytelling. You know, what's the moral of the story? Well, yeah, that can be you know, if you're not driving it home in a, like a nail or something, then of course, you know, the moral of the story is intentionally left a bit ambiguous. And that's the power of a right. story sometimes, you know, oftentimes.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, in my case, that's often been why I used music to I put it soft on the edges, but you're right. I mean, it's the same thing. It's that, you know, that ambiguous character of the story is what allows it to communicate more freely. But with that freer communication, you know, you have to be sort of willing to be misunderstood and, you know, have to know how you want to react to that or respond to it rather.
Yeah. You just changing the subject a bit, but the trajectory of your career as a musician, and which has been quite an active career of a lot of recording and touring and performing in different bands, it has coincided with the collapse of the music industry. I believe you started, you kind of hit the road around the time that the music industry was beginning its collapse. And it's been, I mean, it is now like more than, I think 5 times smaller than it was in the late 90s. It's shrunk to, you know, by 80%. And that's like, I mean, my experience has been that is not something that's only affected, big pop stars. It's basically affected all of us to one degree or another, but really quite profoundly, like on a financial level. And I noticed that at least one of the records, one of the albums you put out, you did not put on streaming platforms. And I'm just curious about your reflection on being a musician in the course of a dying industry as the industry is collapsing.
It's interesting because when I started seriously making music in a really active way as an adult, at least, I was doing music with a musician who lived in England, who lives in England, and we would write songs and record them over email, and that, I mean, for like a long time, for like a few years, this was like the extent of my musical activity. It was, you know, writing songs with somebody that I didn't have any kind of visceral interaction with, which is such a weird way to make music, since music is itself such a visceral activity or experience. But I hadn't really thought of it as coinciding with with what you called the the death of the music industry. But you're right. It's kind of telling in a way that was the kind of music that I was making, or that was the method of production that I was using, given what was happening to the music industry at the time, or what was beginning to happen. That's an interesting connection. I hadn't actually thought about that in terms of my own personal experience.
It is kind of telling in the sense that, like, I mean, in various possible ways, but in one sense that, like, before, like, I guess just basically a little bit before you started traveling and touring, the touring was actually, it was a pretty easy way to make money. Like, it seems like so strange to say now, but people did it because you made money at it. Like, that was one of the main reasons you did it, was not to promote an album, that you were just spent money recording so that you can then do a tour and spend money promoting this album that nobody's ever going to buy. I mean, it was a whole different thing. You if people liked your music, they basically had to buy recordings, unless they were really into spending a lot of time in front of tape machines and making copies, you know. But basically, you made recordings, people bought them, and that was an easy transactional kind of thing. And so then you toured. So you'd be much more likely to go to England and meet the person, is what I'm saying. It's like that, right, you know, right. If it were back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I myself never actually, for all the music that I put out, over a span of I guess around of around 11 years. I've been making music, but I never once actually went on an actual tour. I did a lot of shows in New York City and a couple in Connecticut, but I never once sort of, went on the road, so to speak. I've never done that. But I think,
Wow.
I've probably spent enough money just, touring the city, that it probably comes out to, how much a tour would have cost before, before 2009 or whatever.
Yeah. But it's and but you never did a tour basically because it was for one was one reason because you couldn't figure out how to make it work financially, like how would this actually pay for itself? Was that part of the equation?
Yeah, well, it was stuff like it was finances, and just precarity of work situations,
Yeah.
or and then probably, I don't think I would have said this at the time, but probably some amount of social anxiety probably kept me from doing more traveling in general, not even just touring. Kind of kept me in the home, so to speak, right? To bring it back to domestication momentarily. So
Yeah.
that's, yeah, that's definitely kind of helped me back in some ways. But yeah, I mean, I guess maybe not necessarily held me back. I think the fact that I made music for like 6 or 7 years with somebody in another continent, that's, it's just kind of shows you that you can do a lot with the limited resources at your disposal.
Oh yeah, absolutely, right? I think there's more people probably making music now than perhaps ever, but there's only I think from one sentence census to the last, there are 41% fewer people in the United States who call themselves musicians, like in the professional sense. Which yeah, which not that there's fewer people making music, but yeah, it's
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's also interesting, like having begun, and I don't tend to use this word, but I'll use it because you used it. Having begun my musical career, on the internet, and then to release an album that, you indicated I it wasn't on any kind of streaming platforms. It's kind of an interesting, like, culmination of that musical career. I mean, it wasn't, just to clarify, that wasn't necessarily my own decision in the moment,
it was the
but
album, right? I mean, it was
it
the
was,
label, right?
yeah, it was the label, wanted to, release some music that would not be on the internet.
Right. But then
And
if you're
I,
not touring, then that makes it kind of does then that like I would think that would only work if you were doing a lot of touring.
Yeah, I mean, work, yes. It would have only worked if I were doing a lot of touring. Which I suppose probably at the time I thought, oh, I will, or I'm going to, and my life has been rather rocky at times, probably like many musicians' lives are.
Right.
But I'm pretty happy with the fact that album, or EP, wasn't on the internet and remains not on the internet to this day. I kind of like that, just because it gives the album itself a kind of a different kind of intimacy. This is not something that's just available for free, on your phone, on this sort of weird, like, publicly intimate device that you keep in your pocket. It's something that for the few people in the world who have it, it's something that's kind of like a little bit more secretive in a way, because it's not on the internet, and it was released kind of as a like a bonus CD with another record on the album. So for those people who got it, it was sort of like just this random thing that came in the mail when they ordered what they actually wanted.
Nice.
So it's sort of, I don't know, I'm sort of kind of happy with that. element of the release. So that
Yeah.
kind of, especially given, you know, the amount of time I spent on the internet for the beginning of my musical activity. So
Yeah.
it's sort of nice to have it culminate in this kind of purposely non-internet release.
Yeah. Well, Ben, there's a lot more we could talk about, actually, but that's kind of the nature of these things. But thanks so much for joining me for the hour, and hope to see you around in at least in cyberspace or in the physical world, perhaps as well.
Same here. Thanks a lot for having me, David.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Take care.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in to another episode of Fifth Estate Live. This has been a conversation with Ben Olson, who will be contributing an article to the upcoming issue of the Fifth Estate. You can hear Fifth Estate Live every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, Cable Community Radio, and elsewhere. You'll find all the Fifth Estate Live episodes at fifthestate.org, where you can also subscribe to the physical magazine or read the latest edition online, at least the spring edition, not necessarily everyone. You can also find these interviews and my other interviews archived in various places in the Discussions with David playlist at youtube.com/drovix and in audio form at soundcloud.com/davidrovix, at patreon.com/davidrovix, where you can also support my broadcasting efforts and check out lots of other content, or if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform. If you're somewhere in the region of Portland, Oregon, please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up for text notifications to be part of Portland Emergency Eviction Response to help us mobilize against the coming waves of evictions. I've got a crowdfunder for an album project going, also known as a musician and audio engineer employment scheme. You can check that out at davidrovix.com/pandemic sessions. Remember, don't pay the rent and don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. See you soon.